This is your Spooky Stories podcast with your hosts, Evelyn and Kayliana, coming from Flagstaff, Arizona, to help celebrate your Halloween season.
Welcome back to the Spooky Stories podcast. I'm your host, Evelyn Ibanez.
And I'm your host, Kayliana Jones. Our podcast is meant for our horror story readers out there who love a good scare, so we read scary stories and give you our takes on them.
Our first story is a spin on the classic myth of La Llorona. La Llorona is a Mexican folklore I was always told as a kid, which is why the story intrigued me. It is called Lacrimosa by Silvia Moreno Garcia. The woman is a mound of dirt and rags pushing a squeaky shopping cart, a lump that moves steadily, slowly forward, as if dragged by an invisible tide. Her long, greasy hair hides her face, but Ramon feels her staring at him. He looks ahead. The best thing to do with the homeless mob littering Vancouver is to ignore it. Give them a buck and their beggars cling to you like barnacles. "Have you seen my children?" the woman asks, her voice sandpaper against his ears, makes him shiver. His heart jolts as though someone has pricked it with a needle. He keeps on walking, but much faster now. It isn't until he is shoving the milk inside the fridge that he realizes the woman's words have upset him. She reminds him of La Llorona. He hasn't thought of her in years, not since his child living in Portero. Everyone in town had a story about La Llorona. The most common tale was that she drowned her kids in the river and afterwards roamed the town searching for them at night. Her pitiful cries are a warning and an omen. Camilo, Ramon's great uncle, swore on his mother's grave that he met this ghost while riding home one night. It was the rainy season when the rivers overflow and Camilo was forced to take a secondary, unfamiliar road. Spotted a woman in white bending over some nopales at the side of the lonely path. Her face was covered with the spines of the prickly pears she had savagely bitten open. She turned around and smiled. Blood dripped from her mouth and stained her white shirt. This was the kind of story that locals whispered about around Portero. It was utter nonsense, especially coming from the lips of a chronic alcoholic like Camilo. But it was explosive stuff for an 8-year-old boy who stayed up late to watch black and white horror flicks on the battered TV set. However, to think about La Llorona there in the middle of the city between the SkyTrain tracks and the pawn shop is ridiculous. Ramon never packed ghost stories in his suitcase, and Portero and La Llorona are very far away. He sees a homeless woman sitting behind a narrow ledge, shielding herself from the rain. She weeps and hugs a plastic bag as though it were a newborn child. "Have you seen my children?" she asks when he rushes by clutching his umbrella. Nearby, a man sleeps in front of an abandoned store and an ugly old dog curled up next to him. Downtown homeless Pica Ramon from the shadows as he steps over old cigarette butts. They say this is an up-and-coming neighborhood, but each day he spots a new beggar wielding an empty paper cup at his face. It is disgraceful. This is the very reason why he left Mexico. He escaped the stinking misery of his childhood and the tiny bedroom with the black and white TV set he had to share with his cousins. Behind his house, there was prickly pears and emptiness. No roads and no buildings. Just a bare nothing swallowed by the purple horizon. It was easy to believe that La Llorona roamed there. But not in Vancouver, which is a new and shiny, foaming with lattes and tiny condos. The dogs are howling. They scare him. Wild stray animals that roam the back of the house at night. His uncle told him the dogs howled when they saw La Llorona. Ramon runs to the girl's room and sneaks into his mother's bed, terrified of the noise, and his mother has to hold him in her arms until he falls asleep. But when he wakes up, Ramon is in his apartment and in his only one dog, and the neighbor's Doberman barking. He rolls to the center of the bed, staring at the ceiling. Ramon spots the woman a week later, his arms wrapped around her knees. "My children," she asks, with her cloud of dirty hair obscuring her face. "Where are my children?" Nauseating in her madness, a disgusting sigh growing like a canker sore and invading his streets. Just like the other homeless littering the area, the man in front of the drugstore that always asks him for spare change, even though Ramon never gives him any, or the gnarled man behind a familiar blanket, internally sleeping in the shade of the burger joint. The city is heading to the gutter. Sure, it looks pretty from afar with its tall glass buildings and its mountains, but below there is a depressing stew of junkies and panhandlers that mars the view. It reminds him of Portero and the bedroom with the leaky ceiling. He stared at the small leak, which grew to become an obscene dark patch above his bed, until one day he grabbed his things and headed north. He felt like repeating his youthful impulses, gathering his belongings in a duffel bag and leaving the gray skies of Vancouver. But he had the condo, which would fetch a killing one day if he was patient. His job and all the other anchors that a man pushing 40 can accumulate. A few years before, maybe. Now it seems like a colossal waste of time. Ramon tries to comfort himself with the thought that one day, when he retires, he will move to a tropical island of pristine white beaches and blue-green seas, where the wrecks of humanity can never wash ashore. He's gone to buy groceries, and there she is, picking cans out of the garbage in the alley behind the supermarket, Llorona. He used to send a postcard to his mother every year when he was younger, newly arrived in the States. He couldn't send any money because dishwashing didn't leave you with any spare dollars, and he couldn't phone often because he rented a room in a house and there was no phone jack in there. If he wanted to make a call, he had to use a payphone across the street. Instead, he sends postcards. Carmen didn't like it. His sister complained about the lack of financial support for their mother. "Why do I have to care for Mom, huh? Why is it me stuck in this house with her?" she asked. "Don't be melodramatic. You like living with Mom. You're off in California and never sent a goddamn cent. It ain't easy. It ain't easy here either, Ramon. You're just like the other shitty man, just taking off and leaving the land and the woman behind. Who's gonna take care of Mom when she gets sick and old? Who's gonna clean the house and dust it then? With what fucking money? I ain't doing it, Ramon. Bye, Carmen. There's some things you can't get rid of, Ramon." He didn't call after that. He was heading to another city, and by the time he reached Canada, he didn't bother to send postcards. He figured he would one day, but things got in the way, and years later he thought it would be even worse if he tried to phone. And what would they talk about now? It had been ages since he left home, and the sisters and cousins that had lived in Portero, he'd gotten rid of layers and layers of the old Ramon, mounting into a new man. But maybe Carbon had been right. Maybe there's some things you can't get rid of, certain memories, certain stories, certain fears that cling to the skin of the old scars. These things follow you. Maybe ghosts can follow you too. It's a bad morning. Assholes at work in the streets, and then a heavy, disgusting rain pours down, almost a sludge that swallows the sidewalks. His umbrella and walks with his hands jammed inside the pocket, his jean pockets, head down. 4 more blocks and he'll be home. When Ramon hears the squeal, the high-pitched noise, it's a shriek, a moan, and a sound he's never heard before. What the hell is that? He turned and looked at the old woman, the one he's nicknamed Llorona, pushing her shopping cart. Squeak, squeak goes the shopping cart, matching each of his steps. Squeak, squeak, a metal chirping echoed by a low mumble. Children, 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 squeak, 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 a metal chant with an old rhythm. He walks faster. The cart matches his pace, wheels roll. He doubles his efforts, hurrying to cross the street before the light changes. The cart groans closer than before, nipping at his heels. He thinks she's about to hit him with the damn thing. And then all of a sudden, the sound stops. He looks over his shoulder. The woman is gone. She's veered into the alley, vanishing behind a large dumpster. Ramon runs home. The dogs are howling again, a howl that is a wail. The wind roars like a demon. The rain scratches the windows, begging to be let in, and he lies under the covers, terrified. He feels his mother's arms around his body, her hands smoothing his hair, like she did when he was scared, just a little boy terrified of the phantoms that wander through the panes. His mother's hand pats his own. Mother's hand is bony, gnarled long fingers with filthy nails, nails caked with dirt, the smell of mud, putrid garbage, and mold hit him hard. He looks at his mother, and her hair is a tangle of gray. Her yellow smile paints the dark. He leaps from the bed. When he hits the floor, he realizes the room is filled with 3 inches of water. Have you seen my children? The dogs howl, and he wakes up, his face buried in the pillow. He takes a cab to work. He feels safer that way. The streets are her domain, her own. She owns the alley. When he goes to lunch, he looks at the puddles and thinks about babies drowning in the water, corpses floating down a silver river. Don't ever let the Llorona look at you, his uncle said. Once she's seen you, she'll follow you home and haunt you to death, little boy. Oh, my child, she'll scream and drag you into the river. But he'd left her behind in Portero. He thought he'd left her behind. Ramon tries to recall if there is a charm or remedy against an evil spirit. His uncle never mentioned one. The only cure he knew was his mother's embrace. There, there, little one, she said, and he nestled safe against her while the river overflowed and lightning traced in the sky. In the morning, there was a patch of sunlight. Ramon dared to walk a few blocks, but even without the rain, the city feels washed out. Its color has been drained. It resembles the monochromatic images they broadcasted on the cheap television set of his youth. Even though he does not bump into her, the Llorona's presence lays thick over the streets, pieces of darkness clinging to the walls and the dumpsters in the alley. It even seems to spread over the people. The glassy eyes of a binner reflect the river instead of the bricks of the building. He hurries back home and locks the door, but when it rains again, water leaks into the living room, just a few drops drifting into his apartment. He wipes the floor clean. More water seeps in like a festering boil, cut open and oozing disease. The Llorona stands guard in the alley. She is a lump in the night, looking at his apartment window. He feels her through the concrete walls and the glass, looking for him. He fishes an old notebook with the smudges and forgotten number. The rain splashes against his building, and the wind cries like a woman. The dial tone is loud against his ear. More than 10 years have passed. He had no idea what he'll say. He doesn't even understand what he wants to ask. He can't politely request to ship the ghost back to Mexico. He dials. The number has been disconnected. He thinks about Carmen and his mother and the dusty nothingness behind their house. There might not even be a house. Perhaps the night and the river swallowed them. The Llorona comes with the rain, or maybe it is the other way around. The rain comes with her. Something else also comes, darkness. His apartment grows dimmer. He remains in the pool of light, away from the blackness. Outside in the alley, La Llorona scratches in the dumpster with her nails. The dogs howl. Ramon shivers in his bed and thinks about his mother and how she used to drive the ghosts away. She is sitting next to the heap of garbage in the middle of the alley, water pouring down her shoulders. She clutches rags of dirt and pieces of plastic against her chest, her head bowed and her face hidden behind her screen of hair. My children, my children. She looks up at him slowly. The rain coats her face, tracing dirty rivulets along her cheeks. He expects an image out of a nightmare, blood dripping, yellow cat eye, or a worn skull. But this is an old woman. Her skin has been torn by time, and her eyes are cloudy. This is an old woman. She could be his mother. She might be, for all he knows. He lost her photograph a long time ago and can't recall what she looks like anymore. His mother, who ran her fingers through his hair and hugged him until the ghosts vanished. Now he's too old for ghosts, but the ghosts still come at night. The woman looks at him, parched, forgotten, and afraid. I've lost my children, she whispers with her voice of dead leaves. The alley is a river. He goes to her, sinks into the muck, sinks into the silvery water. He embraces her and she strokes his hair. The sky above is black and white, like the picture in the old TV set. And the wind that howls in his ear is like a demon, is like the demon wind of his child.
So, La Llorona, I've heard of La Llorona, but I've never really heard the story. So I don't know exactly what La Llorona even means, really.
Yeah, so it's like the weeping woman. That's like the translation.
She did do a lot of weeping in that story. It was such like a, it was less of like a horror, but like such a psychological thing. Like I would have freaked out if I was sleeping and then I see a woman in my dreams, but the woman's real and then she's like,
and just like seeing her in the streets and
stuff. Oh my gosh, just seeing her in the streets and thinking like that's a random woman, but this kid has been haunted since like childhood. Since like in a whole other country. This chick followed him to a whole other country.
I feel like that's how, like, ghosts and, like, demons are.
That they follow you?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely feel that. In the end, did he end up, like, drowning himself? I wasn't clear on the ending. Like, did he, like, kill himself with her?
I don't know. I think they were
like, she's already dead, but...
Yeah, she is.
It made it sound like he was killing himself, like, that she lured him into water.
Yeah, finally
and just,
lured him in.
Or maybe it was, like, more of, like, a psychological thing. Like, he just completely, like, went mental.
Yeah. After maybe a while. He's just, like, blocking her out.
He's just gone.
No, yeah. Because, like, in, like, the story of La Llorona, it's basically, like, she... I don't know. Like, her husband left him. Or her husband left her. And then she, like, started going crazy. Mm-hmm. Taking care of her kids. And then one day she just drowned her kids. And now, like... She got cursed.
That guilt,
yeah, basically. She's like got cursed into like looking for her kids for like eternity. So.
So she thinks she found them.
Yeah.
Or one of them, anyways.
Yeah.
And this kid.
Yeah, cause like, for me, like how it was told to me, like as a kid, was like, oh, if you cry at night, like she's gonna hear you and she's gonna find you and get you and like. Yeah, so it was kind of like you gotta like. Like, go to bed, like, go to bed, kind of thing.
That would have absolutely traumatized me.
It was, like, yeah, like, a discipline thing. But I've had, like, because, like, one of my tias, like, she, like, fully, like, believes that she, like, saw her in Mexico.
Really?
Yeah, and every time I go to Mexico, I'm like, oh, I don't want to be outside
too
late.
Does your aunt think that she's, like, getting followed by La Llorona, like, all this time after?
No, because, like, all you do is, like, you just hear her cries. Oh. Like, you hear her just, like, crying. Or, like, an older woman crying.
Oh. So she doesn't actually, like, usually follow people.
Yeah, no.
Or, like, haunt them. She
no,
just, like,
unless you,
like... a presence that you know and you can feel and you can hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could head down to Mexico now. You know, I've been looking forward to it, but I don't know if I want to mess with her and have her haunt my dreams and want to have me as her child. I don't know if I'd want her as my mother either.
No, yeah.
But I really like that story. Usually I feel like scary stuff and scary movies and scary stories are always like super like, what's the word? Very bloody, very gore, very gross, and I'm not a person who likes that. So I quite like the story and the fact that there wasn't that, and it was more like a psychological constant fear thing. I'm all for that.
Yeah.
That's a great thing. I'm here for it.
I always, like,
like more psychological stuff.
Yeah,
but I do think gore is like cool, but like just like the way that they like do it, like the practical stuff, like the actual like things that go like on behind the scenes of like how they like made like this like brain or something. Like I like like knowing like, oh, that was like gum or something, like they made it out of gum or something. But yeah, I don't know. I just like this story, yeah, because it's like psychological. And like a lot of people have like their stories of like La Llorona and like their childhood like traumas with her.
It's something a lot of people can relate to. It's a shared childhood trauma of getting haunted by this ghost.
Of like her just like roaming around and stuff.
But I would definitely like to read more stories like that.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like a lot of like folklore stuff is like.
Is that the genre more for folklore?
Yeah, because I feel like it's just like. Like, I don't know, just, like, stories people grow up listening to, and then, like,
it, like passed on. Yeah. I love stories like that. I think there needs to be more of those.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, our next spooky story is written by Robert Louis Stevenson, the very author of some classic stories like Treasure Island and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I am not one for scary stories, but this story intrigued me simply because of two things. One, the title, and two, the plot being based off of real murders in 1828. Now, here is The Body Snatcher, written by Robert Louis Stevenson. Before the week was out, MacFarlane's prophecy had been fulfilled. Fetz had outlived his terrors and had forgotten his baseness. He began to plume himself upon his courage and had so arranged the story in his mind that he could look back on these events with an unhealthy pride. Of his accomplice, he saw but little. They met, of course, in the business of class. They received their orders together from Mr. K. At times, they had a word or two in private, and MacFarlane was from first to last particularly kind and jovial, but it was plain that he avoided any reference to a common secret, and even when Fetz whispered to him that he had cast in his lots with the lions and forsworn the lambs, he only signed to him smilingly to hold his peace. At length an occasion arose which threw the pair once more into a closer union. Mr. K was again short of subjects, pupils were eager, and it was part of this teacher's pretensions to be always well supplied. At the same time, there came the news of a burial in the rustic graveyard of Glencourse. Time has little changed the place in question. It stood then, as now, upon a crossroad, out of call of human habitations, and buried fathom deep in the foliage of six cedar trees. The cries of the sheep upon the neighboring hills, the streamlets upon either hand, one loudly singing among pebbles, the other dripping furtively from pond to pond, the stir of the wind in mountainous old flowery chestnuts, and once in 7 days the voice of the bell and the old tubes of the precentor were the only sounds that disturbed the silence around the rural church. The Resurrection Man, to use a byname of the period, was not to be deterred by any of the sanctities of customary piety. It was part of his trade to despise and desecrate the scrolls and trumpets of old tombs, the paths worn by the feet of worshippers and mourners, and the offerings and the inscriptions of the bereaved affection. To rustic neighborhoods, where love is more than commonly tenacious, and where some bonds of blood or fellowship unite the entire society of a parish, the body snatcher, far from being repelled by natural respect, was attracted by the ease and safety of the task. To bodies that have been laid in earth in joyful expectation of a far different awakening, there cast that hasty, lamplit, terror-haunted resurrection of the spade and mattock. The coffin was forced, the cerements torn, and the melancholy relics clad in sackcloth, after being rattled for hours on moonless byways, were at length exposed to uttermost indignities before a class of gaping boys. Somewhat as two vultures may swoop upon a dying lamb, Fetz and MacFarlane were to be let loose upon a grave in that green and quiet resting place. The wife of a farmer, a woman who had lived for 60 years and had been known for nothing but good butter and a godly conversation, was to be rooted from her grave at midnight. Was to be rooted from her grave at midnight and carried dead and naked to that faraway city that she had always honored with her Sunday's best. The place beside her family was to be empty till the crack of doom, her innocent and almost venerable members to be exposed to that curiosity of the anatomist. Late one afternoon, the pair set forth, well wrapped in cloaks and furnished with a formidable bottle. It rained without remission, a cold, dense, lashing rain. Now and again, there blew a puff of wind, but these sheets of falling water kept it down. Bottle and all, it was a sad and silent drive as far as Bottle and all, it was a sad and silent drive as far as Penicuik, where they were to spend the evening. They stopped once to hide their implements in a thick bush not far from the churchyard, and once again at the Fisher's Tryst to have a toast before the kitchen fire and vary their nips of whiskey with a glass of ale. When they reached their journey's end, the gig was housed. The horse was fed and comforted, and the two young doctors in a private room sat down to the best dinner and the best wine the house could afford. The lights, the fire, the beating rain upon the window, the cold, ingruous work that lay before them added zest to their enjoyment of the meal. With every glass, their cordiality increased. Soon McFarlane handed a little pile of gold to his companion. "A compliment," he said. "Between friends, these little DD accommodations ought to fly like pipe lights." Fetz pocketed the money and applauded the sentiment to the echo. "You are a philosopher," he cried. "I was an ass till I knew you. You and Kay, between you, by the Lord Harry, but you'll make a man of me." "Of course we shall," applauded McFarlane. "A man, I tell you, it required a man to back me up the other morning. There are some big, brawling 40-year-old cowards who have turned sick at the look of the DD thing, but not you. You kept your head. I watched you." "Well, and why not?" Fetz thus vaunted himself. "It is no affair of mine. There was nothing to gain on the one side of disturbance, and on the other I could count on your gratitude, don't you see?" And he slapped his pocket till the gold pieces rang. McFarlane somehow felt a certain touch of alarm at these unpleasant words. He may have regretted that he had taught his young companion so successfully, but he had no time to interfere, for the other noisily continued in this boastful strain. "The great thing is to not be afraid. Now, between you and me, I don't want to hang. That's practical. But for all cant, McFarlane, I was born with the contempt. Hell, God, devil, right, wrong, sin, crime, and all the old gallery of curiosities. They may frighten boys, but men of the world like you and me despise them. Here's to the memory of Gray." It was by this time growing somewhat late. The gig, according to order, was brought round to the door with both lamps brightly shining, and the young men had to pay their bill and take the road. They announced that they were bound for Peebles and drove in that direction till they were clear of the last two houses of town. Then, extinguishing the lamps, returned upon their course and followed a by-road toward Glencorse. There was no sound but that of their own passage and the incessant, strident pouring of the rain. It was pitch dark. Here and there was a white gate or a white stone in the wall guiding them for a short space across the night. But for the most part, it was at a foot pace, and almost groping, that they had picked their way through that resident blackness in their solemn and isolated destination. In the sunken woods that traversed the neighborhood of the burying ground that last glimmer failed them, and it became necessary to kindle a match and reillumine one of the lanterns of the gig. Thus, under the dripping trees and environed by huge and moving shadows, they reached the scene of their unhallowed labors. They were both experienced in such affairs, and powerful with the spade, and they had scarce been 20 minutes at their task before they were rewarded by a dull rattle on the coffin lid. At the same moment, McFarlane, having hurt his hand upon a stone, flung it carelessly above his head. The grave, in which they now stood almost to the shoulders, was close to the edge of the plateau of the graveyard, and the gig lamp had been propped, the better to illuminate their labors against a tree, and on the immediate verge of the steep bank descending to the stream. Chance had taken a sure aim with the stone. Then came a clang of broken glass. Night fell upon them. Sounds alternately dull and ringing announced the bounding of the lantern down the bank, and its occasional collision with the trees. A stone or two, which had been dislodged in its ascent, rattled behind it in the profundities of the glen, and then silence, like night, resumed its sway, and they might bend their hearing to its utmost pitch, but naught was to be heard except the rain, now marching to the wind, now steadily falling over miles of open country. They were so nearly at the end of their abhorred task that they judged it wisest to complete it in the dark. The coffin was exhumed and broken open, the body inserted in the dripping sack, and carried between them to the gig. One mounted to keep it in its place, and the other, taking the horse by the mouth, groped along by the wall and bush until they reached the wider road by the Fisher's Tryst. Here was a faint, diffused radiancy, which they hailed like daylight. By that, they pushed the horse at a good pace and began to rattle along merrily in the direction of the town. They had both been wetted to the skin during their operations, and now as the gig jumped among the deep ruts, the thing that stood propped between them fell now upon one and now upon the other. At every repetition of the horrid contact, each instinctively repelled it with the greater haste, and the process, natural although it was, began to tell upon the nerves of the companions. McFarlane made some ill-favored jest about the farmer's wife, but it came hollowly from his lips, and was allowed to drop in silence. Still, though, a natural burden bumped from side to side, and now the head would be laid as if in confidence upon their shoulders, and now the drenching sackcloth would flap icily about their faces. A creeping chill began to possess the soul of Fetz. He peered at the bundle, and it seemed somehow larger than at first. All over the countryside and from every degree of distance, the farm dogs accompanied their passage with tragic ululations, and it grew and grew upon his mind that some unnatural miracle had been accomplished, that some nameless change had befallen the dead body, and that it was in fear of their unholy burden that the dogs were howling. "For God's sake," he said, making a great effort to arrive at speech, "for God's sake, let's have a light." Seemingly, McFarlane was affected in the same direction, for, though he made no reply, he stopped the horse, passing the reins to his companion, got down, and proceeded to kindle the remaining lamp. They had by that time got no farther than the crossroad down to Auchinclinny. The rain still poured as though the deluge were returning, and it was no easy matter to make a light in such a world of wet and darkness. When at last the flickering blue flame had been transferred to the wick and began to expand and clarify and shed a wide circle of misty brightness round the gig, it became possible for the two young men to see each other and the thing they had along with them. The rain had molded the rough sack into the outlines of the body underneath. The head was distinct from the trunk, the shoulders plainly modeled. Something at once spectral and human riveted their eyes upon the ghastly comrade of their drive. For some time, McFarlane stood motionless, holding up the lamp. A nameless dread was swathed, like a wet sheet, about the body, and tightened the white skin upon the face of Fetz. A fear that was meaningless, a horror of what could not be, kept mounting to his brain. Another beat of the watch, and he had spoken, but his comrade forestalled him. "That is not a woman," said McFarlane in a hushed voice. So, what did you think? What do we think of this, what's it called? Body Snatcher story. Interesting title.
I think it was, it's very old-timey.
It was very old English. When I first saw it, I didn't realize that it was so old English until I read it. And then I was like, this is interesting and very cool, but it's very, some of these words are hard to understand. Yeah. It makes the plot harder to follow. But it is an older classical story by a classic writer.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could tell because just, like, the way that they spoke to each other and, mm-hmm. like, all, like, the vocabulary that they used was, like, very old.
Yeah, it also definitely gave, like, the feeling of, like, creepy, but I didn't really see the full plot, really.
Yeah.
There's more to that story, obviously, that I didn't do because a lot of it is just, like, intro and, like, background.
Yeah.
But it also didn't, I'm not gonna say it didn't add much to it, but it didn't give what you want from a scary story.
Yeah.
You want to be scared. You want to be freaked out. You want to have nightmares. And I just don't get that from this.
Yeah, no, not really. It's, like, more like a creepy rather than, like, a scare. Especially with, like, the ending of, like, what happened to this woman.
Yeah, I feel like maybe because it's a short story that it's just kind of different. Because I've read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I love that story. And it gave me chills, and it scared me. And maybe that was just because it was a full book, so it was different. So you had, like, more context. And this has less of it because it is a short story. But I still think that the vibe was there, but maybe the effort was there, but maybe not fully achieved the goal here.
Yeah, just because, especially if you have, like, certain, like, word count you want to get, or, like, making, like, a shorter story, it'll, like, not, like, affect the story plot, but, like, affect how much detail and stuff you put into it.
I also just realized it's also from a different time period completely. So it's also like different level of what qualifies as scary.
Yeah.
So maybe just like back then it was more like psychological, subtle, creepy type thing. Whereas now it's very hyped up. It has, as we were saying before, very gory, very violent, very bloody.
Jump scares.
It's crazy. Yeah. But before maybe it was like people's tolerance level was way lower when it came to how scared they get from something. Yeah. So this is kind of like, although I will say this is kind of like, it's still violent. It's still scary. It's just they tell it in a way that's more subtle.
Yeah, more casual.
Definitely more casual. Definitely doesn't amp up the scare very much as like a movie or like a scary story by a writer now would do.
Yeah. But yeah, I liked it. I did like the story though. It's well written and like it gets the point across of like, and I also like how it has like the historical value of like what was scary at the time and like old England and stuff.
I feel like I definitely prefer like this style of like older style type of writing when it comes to scary stories than maybe something newer, just because I'm not a crazy scary person story. Like, I don't like scary stories, so I find like this kind of right up my alley because it's less, not as scary, but more just interesting to read and just see like someone's dark space in their head, but like also kind of in a humane way. Like they're saying something really crazy, but they also say in a way that kind of makes you be like, dang, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes you just think instead of being scared as much, or just like kind of like be, what's it called? Kind of entranced by it in a sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was a good story. Mm-hmm. Wish it was a little more scary, a little more clear, maybe a little more understandable, but it is a time. A different time.
Yeah.
Well, those were some great scary stories. Send in more scary stories you'd like to hear or different types of stories you'd like.
This has been your Spooky Stories Podcast. Hope you liked it and see you guys next time.